Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to These Football Times podcast, a podcast that's going to dig into the people, places and stories that shaped our beautiful game. I'm Rob Fletcher and I'm back in the podcast hot seat. And obviously, we are travelling back to the 1990s with this podcast. We have got a laser-like focus for this episode. You may well have listened to the Aston Villa podcast already, talking about an upcoming magazine at These Football Times. But we are looking solely at two Coca-Cola Cup triumphs during a massive era of change in English football. Joining me today is the man who's captured that story in brilliant detail, Ivan McDowell, author of the book Only the Real Thing, Aston Villa and the Coca-Cola Cup 1993 to 1996. Ivan, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, thanks very much for having me. Excited to delve into some 90s Aston Villa history.
Definitely. And we spent a lot of episodes talking about the 1990s, and it's pretty much all I ever really think about. Those years starting to grow up involved and watching football was absolutely brilliant. From an Aston Villa point of view, obviously quite a big decade, you know, in the early 90s, there's some real successes back into the 80s well under Graham Taylor and then into these League Cups. But what was the kind of state of play for Aston Villa, I suppose, at the start of the decade and kind of their relationship with the League Cup at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned Graham Taylor. So just to sort of that very tail end of the 80s, and you know, Villa had been relegated to the second tier and Taylor had brought us back up, and we'd had quite a shock second place finish, you know, under Taylor. Before then, he went to manage the England national team after Italia 90. So I think we were kind of in a bit of a strange position because Taylor had done really well, but his departure meant that we employed someone called Joseph Venglos, who was perhaps some would say ahead of his time in terms of, you know, the sort of first major foreign manager at a major English club. And I think that we kind of then went through a little bit of a transition there, which didn't follow up Taylor's kind of good work, really, which sort of sets us then into motion of the employment of Ron Atkinson and everything that followed. And I think in terms of the League Cup, we hadn't done anything for quite a while, but had been successful in it. We won the first ever League Cup and then some twin triumphs in the 70s as well with Brian Little and Ray Grade and players like that. So we'd had a kind of a nice sort of connection with the League Cup, but it had been quite a while since we'd perhaps sort of, you know, well, challenged for any major trophy, really, because obviously the FA Cup was long past as well for Villa and still is.
Ron Atkinson's appointment in that early 90s period, obviously Atkinson was quite a well-known manager from United and done well in cup competitions, and then was at Sheffield Wednesday as well, I think, when they beat Manchester United, wasn't it, I think, in 91. What was that like for Villa fans, bringing someone like Atkinson in who had that sort of trophy-winning calibre? Obviously, Taylor had done really well at Watford, made a big name for himself, and obviously carried that on with Villa, kind of bringing you up through the table. Did it feel like a shift with someone like Atkinson? Obviously, someone like Venglos, it didn't work out. Maybe the club, like you say, were a little bit ahead of the time, maybe the manager too. Did it feel like more of a, you know, we are going to possibly go out and try and win something here? It's what Atkinson was kind of known for through that 80s. Did it shift amongst the fans, your kind of thought process about his appointment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we very much saw it, Rob, as, you know, a real opportunity to kind of take that next step. That, you know, although Taylor had consolidated incredibly well, as I say, we, you know, finished second to a very good Liverpool side, I think it felt like it was a kind of a re sort of configuration from Doug Ellis and the club, really, of thinking, actually, you know, we need to really try and, you know, put Villa's name kind of back into the books, if you like, in terms of, you know, either competing in the league and winning the league title potentially, but then, as you say, Atkinson's reputation as a cup winner. And I think that it was, you know, that although Venglos was only there for a year, it wasn't a disastrous year in the sense that we didn't, you know, we didn't get relegated, but, you know, we didn't compete. And it, particularly given that, you know, Taylor had got the side into a second place finish, I think it felt a real disappointment under Wenglosch. And, you know, to his credit, you know, I mean, players of that era now still talk very positively about Wenglosch. So Tony Daly is a really good example of someone who talks about his methods, his training methods, sort of encouraging good habits around nutrition and things like that, that players had clearly never heard of. I guess Daly may have been in the minority of those that were perhaps more willing to take some of that on. And obviously his fans, we didn't, you know, at the time, he didn't necessarily get a sense of that. We just weren't winning a lot of football matches. So big, brash Ron saying all the great things and promising to overhaul the side, et cetera, was kind of manna to Villa fans at that point, I think.
And I think, like you say, I mean, there's quite a good nucleus of players left there from Taylor's time. And then obviously Atkinson then starts to sort of reshape the squad. Ironically, his first season at 91-92 finishing seventh behind Liverpool, who were having their own kind of reshaping of the squad. And when you look at some of the players that, I mean, obviously, you know, back in the day, there was no transfer window until March time. But there were so many players from sort of this run over the next few years that would be brought in by Atkinson, but also people like Dwight York who've been there as well. And talk us through that kind of reshaping of the squad, because, you know, again, it's probably something that Atkinson was quite known for, of, you know, a bit of a wheeler dealer, getting in the players that he wanted. But there were some quite really good names in that 91-92. I'd noticed, obviously, Hugo Hayog came from West Brom, I think, for a very small fee at the time. Daly and Atkinson, Earl Barrett from Oldham, I think, who had quite a good reputation as a decent side. Obviously, Dennis Irwin had come from there at United. Could you see the sort of green shoots coming through in that squad, or do you think it was kind of already there under Wenglosch?
I think that Atkinson absolutely overhauled and probably deserves quite a lot of credit for updating the squad. I think that there's a bit of a myth with Atkinson that he never really sort of developed younger players, which I think is something he would question himself. Because, you know, you mentioned Hugo there as an example. Dwight York had been around, although they probably, you know, certainly Hugo and to a lesser extent Dwight maybe under Atkinson, you know, were starting to come through. But I think it was his purchase of players that potentially either had played for him before or he knew from sort of the first division day. So, you know, you mentioned Daly and Atkinson as an example, but I think probably the quintessential sort of Ron signing to me was Kevin Richardson, who would go on to captain the side in the 94 final. And this was a guy that had, you know, won the league with Arsenal, you know, won trophies with Everton, you know, and really brought a kind of sort of an idea of experience to the Villa side. And I think that was, in some ways, would end up becoming Ron's undoing a little bit. But I think at the time, it was a really important signing. Then he was joined by the likes of Ray Houghton. And then slightly later, Dean Saunders, you know, which takes us sort of into 92-93. So I think there was a good mix. You know, he did see a potential for younger players. You know, as we've said, Hugo, Dwight, Steve Froggatt, another example. But then there was this very much this nucleus of experience. And it wasn't, you know, and I think that drove some of his selection, you know, and you've got the likes of Sean Teal playing alongside Paul McGrath at the centre-back. You mentioned Earl Barrett, who was a centre-back at Oldham, and Ron decided to make him a right-back, which I'm not massively sure Earl Barrett was a huge fan of initially, but I think it was his pace that Ron felt was an opportunity to kind of get everyone in the side, if you like. And then Steve Staunton on the other side, you know, again, another, you know, experienced player that was brought in from Liverpool. So building a real basis of experience and players that he could trust, I think, was important for Ron Atkinson.
I think that sort of big turnover and overhaul, I suppose, of players from different managers helps when the first Premier League season starts, because you're quite well set in terms of your squad, in terms of sort of that strength. And then obviously, you know, Dean Saunders signs for over 2 million and Ray Houghton arrives from Liverpool. You know, for me, it's funny actually, isn't it? You know, your time as a football fan, I had like videos from the late 80s and 90s when I was like 5 or 6, you know, I saw Ray Houghton play for Liverpool. But for me, like, Ray Houghton is so synonymous with Aston Villa from that period of time, like when I'm sort of starting to watch football more seriously and see it on Match of the Day and shoot and match and all those kinds of things. And it was a really kind of astute signing, I think, for Villa, wasn't it? Because it again gave you that, you know, a player with good technical ability to kind of enhance what you already had in midfield. People like Gordon Cowan's obviously been there for a long time, was already in there, and Gary Parker, people like that. And do you think maybe the the bigger signing of someone like Dean Saunders maybe overshadows someone like Ray Houghton, who still actually gave, you know, quite a lot for the club.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it, I mean, Houghton's a really interesting one. And I was, you know, did a podcast with Stephen Scragg around Us and Them with Liverpool and Villa. And we were talking quite a lot about Ray Houghton. And I think that perhaps, you know, that we, you know, being of that sort of slightly younger age where we, I mean, I don't massively remember him at Liverpool, and you kind of underestimate the impact that he had there. And Stephen was very quick to correct me on that. I think with Villa, he was a very much a bit of an unsung kind of hero. You know, it's such a cliche, isn't it? And I think that, you know, that's borne out by the fact that he, you know, his contribution perhaps over this period isn't always hugely recognised. You know, I mean, jumping ahead to the first Coca-Cola Cup winning run, you know, his participation in games leading up to the semi-finals was exemplary, you know, and actually it kind of probably dragged us through a game at Sunderland, which we shouldn't have won, along with Mark Bosnich. And I think because he never played in the final, that almost kind of, you know, he's sort of semi-forgotten in that sense, because he wasn't in the photos at the end, he didn't get on the pitch, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that, you know, we maybe underestimate that. And I think that for Villa fans, the signing of Saunders was so important because and it's a bit of a trope for lots of clubs, isn't it? But we'd so struggled to score goals on a consistent basis that people were incredibly excited about Dean Saunders because it was, you know, this is going to be the answer to that problem. So I think, you know, probably, you know, Dino's signing overshadowed everyone else because, you know, and Ron himself, I think, said, you know, this is the missing piece of the jigsaw. So the ante was upped, you know, once we signed Saunders.
I feel like every football fan feels that their club's ills can be solved by signing that elusive number nine, sort of wherever they come from. I think it was interesting with Saunders, obviously, the fact that obviously it hadn't gone well at Liverpool, or he'd scored goals, but certainly he wasn't kind of the calibre that they were probably looking for to maintain title challenges. But with Villa, you did have a title challenge in that first Premier League season. And, you know, it was a pretty exciting season right towards the end. And, you know, Man United obviously went on a brilliant run towards the back end of the season, whereas Villa, who've been so consistent all the way through, I think it's never easy being in a title race. And I think, obviously, towards the end, you know, 10 points, when you look at it, looks like a huge margin. And maybe you probably feel like, you know, with what, 6 games to go, that you're right in with a shout. But when you've got a team like United who hit form, it's really, really difficult to keep up, isn't it? What are your feelings, I suppose, as a fan? You know, the new, brand new shiny Premier League, you got this striker who's kind of fitting well and is getting goals for you, but it just kind of fell away, didn't it?
It did. I mean, it was, yeah, I mean, it was a great season, you know, and some wonderful results over the season and performances and memories that will, you know, stick in Villa fans' memories for you know, for history, you know, and Daylen Atkinson's goal of the season being at Wimbledon being one of those, and celebrating under the umbrella in the rain, things like that, you know, so iconic stuff. But it did just fall away. And it, you know, I mean, not for the last time, it felt that everything just fell United's way, you know, and it was that very famous game when Steve Bruce scored twice against Sheffield Wednesday at Old Trafford, and you know, in what would become known as Fergie time, etc. But I think it, you know, they were relentless, and obviously it was the beginning of a dynasty, wasn't it, for United? And I think that their relentlessness, coupled with, you know, some really poor results and performances from Villa in the run in, and you know, the game against Oldham at Villa Park is often sort of held up as a real example of that. You know, a game that really we should have won. And, you know, and if you're serious about competing at that end of the table, the games that you should win. So, yeah, it was disappointing because it, you know, it was a drop off and, you know, frustrating, I suppose, because, you know, United, it was, you know, they hadn't necessarily won their own, you know, trophy for quite a long time. So it didn't feel at that point like they were streets ahead of Villa particularly, you know, and I suppose that kind of, you know, history gives us a different lens on that, doesn't it, Rob? Because they were so successful. But at the time, you know, we felt we were their equal, really. So therefore, to fall away in the way that we did was really disappointing, you know, and, you know, certainly represented, you know, Ron Atkinson's last opportunity, really, to push for a league title in his career. So,
Yeah, I think it felt at the time with United, especially they'd been close on a couple of occasions to winning the league, especially 91-92, where obviously Leeds ended up getting past them and lifting the last First Division title. You kind of felt like you could be an equal to a team like that. You maybe didn't feel like that when you were against Liverpool because they had that sort of history of winning. But like you mentioned before there, you know, when a team wins the title and invents the name of stoppage time to be named after their manager, I think it's one of those things where you kind of, you feel like maybe it is up against you a little bit. And obviously those Bruce goals getting them over the line. The following season, 93-94, is kind of when you're hoping that you can kick on and compete in the league. It doesn't quite happen as much as you probably would have wanted it to, kind of dropping down to 10th. But tell us then about this League Cup triumph, because it was a really tough spell towards the back end of the league season, obviously when results started to turn the other way. Certainly leading up to that League Cup final, and we'll talk a little bit more about the final itself in a bit, but what was that run like for the club in the sense that, you know, you weren't up there challenging for a title, but actually you were really competitive and strong in a cup competition?
I mean, it's interesting, and I quote Sean Teal in the book who actually talks about sort of the club's ambitions for 93-94, and actually the focus, the overt focus, according to Teal, was very much on the idea that it was about winning something, and it didn't really matter what that was. It was about winning something. So I think the pain of the second finish the previous season was there to sort of feel. And I think that there was, therefore, a clearly conscious effort to think, right, you know, we can go out and win something and kind of, you know, put our names in the history books, you know, et cetera. So, yeah, so, the, I mean, the run was fantastic. I mean, we played Birmingham City in the in our first round, which then was still a two-legged affair, so home and away. They, I mean, you know, it's inevitable that I will say this. You know, they were, you know, they were not at our level at that point, and obviously still aren't. So, but they certainly didn't. You know, there was still that edge of a second City derby, which, you know, is something that we haven't had for a while. And actually, I for one quite miss Rob, but kind of fairly sort of non-eventful games. But most memorably for Nigel Spink being substituted for Mark Bosnich, and really that became. Mark Bosnich's kind of then trajectory into the first team, and it was very much through this cup run that happened. He saved a penalty when he came on, which would also become a bit of a habit of his. Kevin Richardson was also pushed into the crowd by Paul Tait, who was sent off at Villa Park. 2-1-0 wins, so 2-0 on aggregate. And it, you know, it was a good start. It's always, you know, it's always nice to win a derby, particularly in those kind of in those kind of circumstances, I guess. And then, I mean, Bosnich then absolutely kind of spearheaded, if you like, the next winning against Sunderland, who absolutely battered us, and somehow we ended up coming out scoring four goals. But Mark Bosnich, you know, and again, you know, I've got some quotes from Ron about essentially that, you know, Bosnich had just won Villa the game in Essen. But again, it just felt like there was a little bit of momentum kind of building. And I think that it had been a while, really, in terms of how we, you know, kind of approached a cup campaign. And I think that those two wins had actually sort of made, you know, Villa a little bit more, I suppose, believing, if you like, Rob, that maybe something was maybe on the cards. So, yeah, the Sunderland game was certainly a kind of an interesting one. As I say, absolutely transformed Mark Bosnich's kind of reputation into being, you know, the goalkeeper that he is now known to be, if you like, and probably signaled the end for Nigel Spink.
I think you need games like that, don't you? Like that Sunderland game where you look back and you think, oh, we won that game 4-1. But then actually when you remember it, you think, oh, yeah, actually we were pretty lucky to get out of that, or we took our chances. Or you kind of need that little bit of luck sometimes, I think, where, you know, your back's against the wall a little bit, but you can come out with the win. And I think potentially around that time, obviously, the quality of the players between the two leagues probably wasn't as great as it is now. So you probably feel like in cup competitions, especially playing, you know, Premier League, First Division, even Second Division teams. I know United got beat by York, I think, didn't they, one year? Might have even been that season or the year after, I can't remember now. But, you know, it wasn't a chasm as we probably feel in some of the competitions now. So if Sunderland had beat you, it would have been an upset, obviously, beating the runners-up from the Premier League, but you wouldn't have felt like, oh, we've gone out to, you know, a team in a different league to us or whatever. Do you think that set you up kind of from that point where you thought, actually, you know, we've beaten our local rivals, we've got a good away win here? I mean, you get drawn against Arsenal and Tottenham away in the next two games, which you maybe would have wanted to have something a little bit more straightforward. But, you know, the strength of those performances and the team actually being quite together in those games is such a huge thing, especially when you can kind of feel something, as you say, maybe the players are thinking about, you know, this is our time to win something. Beating two teams like that, I suppose the confidence must have been sky high, even if the league form was patchy, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely was, Robin. And what's interesting, of course, as well, is that these games were not played, you know, they were all away games. Because I think there was, you know, Atkinson was getting to feel a bit of pressure at Villa Park because, you know, they weren't, you know, again, goals, you know, goals continued to be an issue despite Saunders. You know, goals were an issue. And I think he was under that pressure. And I think there was an element of going to Highbury and then White Hart Lane was very much kind of, you know, the side could kind of get on with it a little bit. Which, and I've always thought, I wonder how different that might have been. At a Villa Park can be a, you know, as David O'Leary once mentioned, a kind of fickle sort of place. And I think that, you know, fans do get after the teams a little bit. And I think it could have been very different. But as it was, going to Highbury and, you know, Dalian Atkinson scored the only goal of the game. Andy Townsend was fantastic that night. You know, a real kind of important element that Atkinson had added after that league, that second place finish in the league. And I think he was very much drove our midfield through that campaign. And then the Spurs game with an unusual Earl Barrett goal to seal a 2-1 win. I think, yeah, they were. And when you're winning against those sorts of sides, you know, it's a bit like Villa's FA Cup run this season. You know, you're winning against those sides that you do begin to think, okay, well, you know, we're knocking some of these bigger established teams out, so that can only stand us in good stead. So, and then we got drawn against Tranmere in the semi-final, which on paper was the draw we would have wanted because we certainly didn't want to play Manchester United in the semi-final. So we're glad to avoid them. They played Sheffield Wednesday, I believe. So yeah, we were drawn against Tranmere, which, as I say, on paper looked like it was the draw that we wanted.
And I think that's massive, isn't it? Because at the time, United, that 93-94 United side was an absolute juggernaut. And I know we'll probably come to talk about the final in a little bit in terms of what that was like. It's interesting, the talk about Andy Townsend, he signed for Middlesbrough in 1997 when we got relegated. And I remember I had a season ticket with my dad. I remember saying to him, God, imagine we'd have got him when he was 25. Because I can't even, he must have been 33, dare I say, 34. Because he was sort of around 29, 30, I think, when he signed for you, wasn't he?
But oh, yeah, because he'd been at Chelsea and he'd had a decent career.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And I think just a real quality central midfielder, that he oozed that calm, but he had that tenacity as well. So, I mean, I remember signing him. I think we got him for about 900,000, I think, and it was a really kind of sensible signing compared to what we'd had before that. But you mentioned about playing Tottenham and Arsenal on the way. I mean, obviously, Middlesbrough were a bit of a cup side for that time as well, later on in the Premier League. And we played Newcastle at home and then Liverpool at home on the way to a semi-final against Stockport County. So I think it's interesting how you do often find, or in that decade, there was sort of that team that went under the radar, Stockport. But Tranmere, again, we were fighting with them for the league title in 94-95. There was that Tranmere team, although, you know, if you look at it on paper, you think, well, Villa, Tranmere Rovers, of course they're going to turn them over. But John King had built a good side. Pat Nevin obviously was there. John Aldridge was there. Not an easy team to play against, and certainly not easy when you lose 3-1. I mean, what a crucial goal from Dalian Atkinson in the last minute just to kind of reduce the arrears.
Absolutely. And I think that it absolutely changed the narrative, Rob. So I think if we'd have left Prenton Park 3-0 down on aggregate, that feels very different. And I think because it was literally almost the last action of the game, you know, I think Villa could almost, and fans went home sort of almost with that fresh in the mind, think, actually, you know what, you know, Dalian has just given us a lifeline here, which we need to take. And I think, you know, obviously going back to Villa Park with a two-goal deficit as opposed to three was important. And, you know, and he had that knack, Dalian. I mean, he wasn't prolific, but he had that knack of scoring really, really crucial goals, you know, across his Villa career. You know, much missed, unfortunately. And kind of had a bit of a reputation at Villa of being a bit kind of, you know, my dad used to call him sick note, you know, because he was injured quite a bit. But, you know, he did have that knack of crucial goals. And that one in the semi-final first leg is, well, absolutely up there because it enabled us to go back to Villa Park. And, you know, probably at that point, the best atmosphere I'd ever seen at Villa Park, really. You know, even in that sort of, in those league campaigns of finishing second, it was that they're not those one-off big games necessarily, are they? And I think that it was just, you know, it was a cold day, I remember it, but it was electric. And, you know, from the start, you know, Saunders scores, Sean Teal scores, and it's kind of feels like it's all back on. But then, of course, only for Tranmere to then score and it all be back up in the air. And that man Dalian again to sort of rescue it, really, at the end and send it into extra time. But it was, I mean, it was a topsy-turvy game. And you're right, you know, and Tranmere were a good side. You know, I mean, you know, you mentioned Nevin and Aldridge, but, you know, I mean, Ian Nolan, I think, at left back as well. And, you know, a really decent footballing side who probably could count themselves quite unlucky in the end. And, you know, did incredibly well to take us all the way to penalties, which I think probably Villa were just relieved in the end to kind of get to that point.
There's certainly something to be said about that. I mean, like you say, Atkinson's goals in both of those games are just unbelievably crucial. Like you say, the first leg more from the point of that kind of mental thought of we've got a goal, we've got an away goal, we can sort of hang on to that. But actually, when you think that goal in the semi-final to equalise, obviously, then extra time and penalties, what a different kind of feel that would have been to the rest of the season if that goal hadn't have gone in, because, you know, you weren't necessarily in a championship race. I think Tranmere, like you said, I think probably count themselves a little bit unlucky with what had happened. They'd got in the playoffs that season. They weren't far off. Obviously, 94-95, the year after, it went to one automatic place in the first division because obviously the Premier League was changing size. So they missed out on that. They ended up in the playoffs again for that season, but Bolton took that second promotion place. So, you know, a real what-if story, that Tranmere story. There's definitely a book to be written about that team at some point, I think. But jumping ahead a little bit, we get to the glory moments now of the final. I remember watching this. I feel like it was on ITV at the time.
Yeah, it was. It was, yeah. I mean, having re-watched the commentary several times in the process of this, is that, yeah, because it was Brian Moore and Kevin Keegan was the summarizer.
That's right, yeah.
You're right, it was on ITV.
And I remember thinking at the time, obviously football, we didn't have Sky Sports in our house, so football was quite rare. You could see Champions League games, you could see cup games. We had the big match on Tyne Tees on our right, so we got some of those on a Sunday. But I remember thinking, nobody can beat this Manchester United team. You just felt, you know, you'd seen them on Match of the Day and kind of recorded it and watched it the next day. I mean, it was a real, real juggernaut. What was the Villa kind of feeling about being in a final against a team that looked so strong in the league, certainly?
Yeah, I mean, and they were, it was a phenomenal side, wasn't it? I think there was an element of just being glad to be back at Wembley because it had been a while. And for fans of my generation, it was the first opportunity to go to Wembley, you know, and watch Aston Villa. I think there was one moment that absolutely bolstered Villa fans' belief, and it was actually in the league games that preceded the final. And Peter Schmeichel was sent off for Manchester United, therefore would miss the Coca-Cola Cup final through suspension. And I remember, you know, we used to get the Sports Argus on a Saturday night, so like the football pink. And on that, after the league games of that Saturday, that was the headline: Schmeichel misses final. And I think that was the glimmer of hope somehow that we maybe needed, because, you know, he was such an exceptional goalkeeper that his absence, you know, absolutely would make a difference. You know, but it also felt a little bit like clutching at straws, because of course, you know, Cantona, Ince, Keane, Bruce, the list goes on, Mark Hughes, we're all going to be there. So I think there was an element that we would go and enjoy it. But then we had seen under Atkinson that we were capable of those kind of one-off results. And, you know, that run to the final had been so amazing, really, and so many sort of twists and turns. You know, there was an element, I think, of particularly maybe for people my age at the time that, oh, you know, well, you know, it's kind of written in the stars, Rob. And I think it was probably a shock to everyone then what unfolded, really, because, you know, to go 2-0 up in the way that we did was, yeah, I guess fairly unprecedented, particularly because Ron had changed the side and played Graham Fenton in, well, we've been talking about Ray Houghton. I mean, essentially dropped Ray Houghton in favour of Graham Fenton, who'd only played a handful of Villa games. And to be honest, only played a handful more after. And he was kind of employed in this sort of, you know, I guess now what you might call a kind of roving sort of 10 position, and absolutely drove Villa forward as a young man. And, you know, really kind of gave some option then to have Dalian Atkinson unusually a bit wider with Tony Daly on the other wing with Saunders through the middle. And it was that kind of tactical tweak that, although no one saw coming, kind of probably shook things up a little bit, really, and gave United something else to think about. But yeah, you know, phenomenal day. My massive memory of it is actually Mark Bosnich, because we went 2-0 up and then Mark Hughes scored. It was 2-1. And Bosnich made a save at 2-1, which was out of this world, which, you know, I mean, I, you know, over the years saw Mark Bosnich make quite a lot of outstanding saves. But this one, it just felt at that moment that momentum was maybe just shifting back towards United. And, you know, it felt a bit like, well, you know, the kind of underdog has, you know, sparked them into life a bit. And then now they're going to kind of come back and win it. And I think the save he made at 2-1 was absolutely integral, really, to us to hanging on to that win, and then obviously scoring a late third with the penalty. So, but yeah, phenomenal. And I don't think many people would have put their last pound on Villa that day.
Yeah, definitely. I remember, you know, talking about it in school with my friends, because, you know, United were the team that were always in on the TV, and obviously because it wasn't wall-to-wall football coverage that we had at the time, you know, you didn't even know that much about your own club, because it, you know, you saw it on the local news, but it wasn't like there was football blogs and social media about, you kind of, they were the team that everybody talked about. So that was a huge shock. I remember really kind of thinking what a strange occasion it was for United. But obviously as time goes on, you think about from the other point of view and how Atkinson got it perfectly right, didn't he? He really did get it right. And, you know, you have people like Paul McGrath who, you know, for 15 years have been turning up in big games, performing so brilliantly. And I remember watching him in the World Cup in USA 94. It was kind of the first proper major tournament that I'd seen. I remember thinking what a phenomenal player he actually was. And he'd been brilliant, obviously, for Villa. And then obviously seeing him against some of the world's best was brilliant. That Graham Fenton selection, what a moment to do something like that. But maybe that is how you win in those sorts of situations. You do something completely different that maybe the opposition really can't plan for or haven't got enough time maybe to react, but it turned out that it worked brilliantly.
Well, yeah, and I think it was very wrong to kind of take those sort of risks as well, I think. And he probably knew that in some ways this sort of might be a bit of a, you know, I think I talk in the book about the idea that this season for him was sort of becoming the accumulation of his time at Villa, really. It didn't really feel like it was the start of something. It felt like it was the finish, if that makes sense. And I think he would have been a bit aware of that. So I think it was a case of, well, you know, we are playing a really good side, you know, who will be very familiar with the way that we play. And you know what? Why not take that risk of doing something a little bit different to actually give them something to think about? And, you know, obviously, in, you know, history tells us that ultimately it worked, you know. And I think it was, you know, it was a time when, you know, you were a bit, you know, your squad wasn't as big. You were limited to what you could do, and you know, obviously didn't have a lot of substitutes, things like that. And so I think it was incredibly brave to do that, you know, and perhaps was one of the few things that he could do, really, that was just gonna make United think. Because you're right, you know, the rest of the side was relatively stable, and you probably would have picked everyone else in the side that day probably in advance. And it was just, you know, as I say, Fenton coming in ahead of, as I said, probably Ray Houghton, maybe Gary Parker, but, you know, it was just that real curveball. It's interesting you mentioned USA 94 as well, Rob, because I think that yeah, by extension for me, it's sort of, I almost felt like I was watching Villa when watching Ireland in USA 94, because it was the four, you know, Steve Staunton, Paul McGrath, Ray Houghton and Andy Townsend were, you know, obviously all Villa's players, you know, that followed this League Cup triumph. And I honestly, I have to be careful when I say this sometimes to people, but that is the most involved I've ever felt in an international tournament, you know, like never particularly with England, but it was somehow that Villa connection was just, yeah, really important to me. So yeah, just a little tangent there.
Yeah, but I think that's really interesting, is it? Because the club element to our football fandom is always going to be closer than probably anything else. And when you've got that connection with your own club and a national team, you know, you do start looking out for those players. But I mean, obviously they were brilliant for Ireland in that World Cup as well. And they were such a core part of that team. Interesting that Roy Keane was there, who you'd beat in the final. John Aldridge is there, who you'd beat obviously in the semi-finals.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it was obviously a really strong squad that went there and did well. Post USA 94, I mean, I've written a book about 94, 95, so I'm quite well aware of Villa's, let's call it another transition season, shall we,
yeah.
That one?
Yeah,
as politely as we can. What always struck me about this one, so, you know, I went through all the clubs and you look at where they finished in 93, 94 and what happened to them and you think, well, how are they going to sort of bounce back? And Villa had been pretty secure where they were in the league. But that summer, you know, the signings that Villa made didn't really feel like a side that were going to be challenging in Europe and had just come off the back of winning a trophy. You probably could argue that you had Saunders, Atkinson, York, you know, you had some good strong forwards already, you had a good base in defence, but it didn't feel like let's go back to try and be in top six or top four or maybe moving towards. How did you feel about that? I mean, Phil King, Neil Amtie and John Fashanu was your three.
Well, let's start with John Fashanu. I mean, that... Yeah, I mean, it was just, it didn't make sense because, you know, again, you know, and I'm most clubs have this in a sense, but, you know, we still have this problem scoring goals, despite the fact that we had Dean Saunders, Dan Atkinson, Dwight York, we still lacked that real sort of prolific goal scorer. And Fashanu wasn't that, was it? I mean, he was effective at what he did in a particular Wimbledon side, but it seemed a really strange one, and it somehow pointed to the idea that I think Atkinson was going to try and play a little bit differently, so maybe a little bit more direct to Fashanu, and then kind of have, you know, the likes of Saunders, Atkinson, York sort of off him, picking up the balls, et cetera, et cetera. So it didn't make sense. It wasn't massively popular, I don't think, with Villa fans, but, you know, we just kind of went with it, really, and he ended up only lasting a season, this experiment, and very few impactful moments from Big Fash. But and the other two, I mean, Phil King was someone that had played for Ron at Sheffield Wednesday, and I think it was about cover, really. Neil Cox had I believe come to Middlesbrough, right?
Our first ever £1 million signing, Neil Cox, yeah, big money for us.
A real kind of, actually, sorry, just a real forgotten hero, I think, for Villa, because he made a big contribution for Villa in that cup run as well in 94, covered a lot, you know, covered for Barrett, covered for Staunton. So when he went, I think Phil King was a bit of a kind of a utility cover option. Neil Amtie, again, is, you know, was the Pelé, described him as the next Pelé, so to speak, when he was a very young man playing for Ghana in the under-17 World Cup. And he did. I mean, he had some magical moments for Villa in the League Cup, actually. And I have kind of, I do cover him in the book, really, because he's a really interesting story about, I suppose, missed opportunity, wasted talent. But yeah, I mean, it didn't feel like it was right. Here we go. And I don't know how much of that, Rob, was, you know, maybe Doug Ellis limiting a little bit of maybe the money he wanted to give Atkinson, I guess. You know, just in terms of kind of maybe the players that Ron had brought in, you know, whether there was a need to kind of look at some of those younger players that you'd mentioned. You know, Dwight York still wasn't starting regularly. You know, Hugo was kind of on the cusp of that. So maybe a bit of a change of focus. But yeah, it felt like a strange off-season, you know, in the sense that we'd won that League Cup. And yeah, it was felt more like consolidation than sort of evolution, I guess.
Yeah, when you look at it, I think the club pretty much breaks even over the course of the full season in terms of transfers. So it was kind of a little bit of a reset, I suppose, rather than trying to sort of invest too heavily. And obviously there's a managerial change during this season as well in terms of Brian Little coming in for Ron Atkinson, who then tries to buy some players himself as well. He brings in Ian Taylor, who for me is one of the most synonymous players with Villa from that period of time. And obviously watching and a lot of 90s football and growing up with that. And that was a really great signing. Gary Charles, again, another one from that era who you kind of feel like. Alan Wright, again. You know, these players that Little was bringing in, it's kind of, this is where it started, this kind of season where you've pretty much just stayed up. I remember researching the book for this. I always thought Villa were much better in this season from a position-wise. Obviously, when he came in, you got a bit of a bounce and you got some good results. And then it really tailed off again like it had under Atkinson as well, obviously towards the end of the season. And although, you know, you didn't finish in a great place in terms of when you look at the league table, but it certainly looked a lot better earlier on under Little's tenure. But there was always that thing underlying that maybe he's going to get it right if we can just sort of sort out a few of these players and get them in the right position. It kind of looked like you were moving in the right direction.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you got to remember, Rob, that when he walked into Villa Park, he could do no wrong because, you know, he was absolutely a Villa Park hero as a player. So I think that put him on the front foot. We did have a massive upturn, you know, and I think at one point we were almost kind of eighth, something like that, and it felt really like, okay, you know, he's worked this out, you know. Taylor was a great signing, and I mean, well, proved to be a great player for many managers after Brian Little, you know, and he's still an actual, you know, real kind of ambassador for the club. And he just brought an energy, because I think there was a feeling that the midfield particularly under Atkinson had become a little bit staid, you know, maybe lacking energy. As great as Kevin Richardson had been, I mean, he didn't miss a game for three seasons. You know, there was just a feeling that him and Hout and Gary Parker they just lacked some of that energy. So I think bringing Taylor in, who was, you know, a real kind of box to box player, could score goals, but, you know, physically very imposing as well, was a masterstroke. And I think the signing of the fullbacks that you mentioned kind of signalled what would become a new way of playing under Little as he really navigated to three centre backs, and therefore felt that he needed some more energy in those fullback positions because they would essentially provide the width. So it was, you know, and we were ultimately fortunate to survive on the last day, and Steve Staunton scored an important goal away at Norwich to get us a crucial point. But it didn't feel, it was odd because I think because of the changes Little had started to bring in, probably, Rob, the fact that it was Brian Little as well, it didn't feel like it was somehow, oh no, like next season we're going to be in trouble sort of thing. It was like, right, well, bring it on, really. And so it proved, in essence.
And what a great season it was that following season. Obviously, we talked already about the second place finish in 92-93, but actually 95-96 was arguably even better than that, even though you were in a title race in 92-93. I remember, again, you know, this is the time when you're getting shoot and match and even started dabbling in a little bit of world soccer. So that sign of Savo Milosevic felt like, for me, 95, 96, 97 is when the Premier League totally changes. 94, 95, I kind of made the argument that you were starting to see what the Premier League was going to become over the back half of the decade. But signing someone like Milosevic and breaking your record for someone who really nobody knew a lot about anyway was a real big statement. But Gareth Southgate and Mark Draper signing those two players, obviously when you look at that, you think, well, actually, there's two really, really good players who are going to form that nucleus going forward for a period of time. Like you say, moving away from the Sean Teals and the Kevin Richardsons and the Paul McGraths, you're kind of future-proofing a little bit, or, you know, certainly trying to build on that win. A big, big chunk of money spent that summer.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. You know, there's such a difference between 95, 96 and what had come before, like just generally in the Premier League. And I think that, you know, hopefully don't make too much of it in the book, but even like the kits, the sponsors, it just felt different. And Savo's a great example of that. And, you know, again, you kind of think of, you know, yeah, it's not like he was the first ever foreign player, you know, but it was those kind of sort of semi-exotic, you've never kind of heard of, but came with a good reputation, always scored all these goals for Partizan Belgrade, like, you know, rocks up wearing a bandana and Doug Ellis is trying to sell bandanas in the Villa Village to, you know, and this sort of thing. And it just felt very different. Draper, you know, I've said before, is a hugely important piece of where Brian Little was looking to go. I think, again, that midfield energy that Taylor had kind of brought in mid-season, he was obviously going to play essentially with a midfield three because he was going to go three centre-backs, then that midfield three, and then two up top. So that essentially looked like it was, for the large part, going to be Ian Taylor, Mark Draper and Andy Townsend. And I think Taylor and Townsend were going to do the hard yards, but Draper was that creative ball player that, you know, Villa didn't really have in their squad, and I think was absolutely critical. And Southgate as well. I mean, I had played in midfield for Palace and was brought in and told by Littlewell, I think you're a centre back, or at least a centre back in a back three. And his presence there, I think, you know, gave a whole new lease of life to Paul McGrath on one side, and then equally Hugo Ehiog on the other. I mean, that is some centre back trio, that, isn't it? And so yeah, it was a real overhaul, and the season couldn't have started any better when we beat United 3-1 at Villa Park.
And what a moment that is, because obviously you'd beaten United in the League Cup 93-94. At the end of 94-95, they get rid of, you know, Hughes, Kanchelskis, Paul Ince. It's a huge change and a huge overhaul for United, but obviously for Villa as well. How did it feel as a fan seeing some of those players who were kind of synonymous under those years under Ron Atkinson that started to leave that summer? So obviously Dean Saunders leaves, Dillian Atkinson leaves, Sean Teal leaves. Was it just a case of, you know, we need Little to have the opportunity to get on with how he wants to do it now, and, you know, those players have been good servants? Did you have that sense of trepidation, or, as you said before, Little was a big Villa legend and you kind of felt like he was moving you in the right direction? Was it just this is the way that we're going now?
Yeah, I mean,
we need to look to that.
It just felt exciting, Rob, which is bizarre, isn't it, when you consider that we escaped relegation on the final day of the season. But it did. It just felt, you know, all that summer, you know, and the signings, as I say, it just felt really transitional at that point. And I think we just had this innate faith in Brian to drive that forward. And we trusted and were excited in the plans that he was, you know, clearly going to bring together. And it was. And I think, you know, when you start the season in that way with a result that, again, people, you know, maybe wouldn't have expected, you know, although, as you say, United had an overhaul themselves, obviously prompted Alan Hansen's famous line about not wearing anything with kids. But, you know, when you start the season like that with such an emphatic win against a side that we still can't beat very often. So, you know, I think that was just the perfect beginning. And then the season as a whole, you know, I mean, it, you know, you think to win the League Cup, a semi-final of the FA Cup, and to finish fourth in the league, I mean, that is, don't get much better than that, really, does it, unfortunately?
Yeah, definitely. And if you look at the league form, was interesting when I had a little look, that you only, apart from the last sort of last four games, you only lost back-to-back games once all season, which, you know, is no mean feat in what was becoming quite a strong Premier League competition in terms of, you know, there was quite a few teams who'd started to spend a little bit of money. You know, that kind of, well, someone like Middlesbrough got a new stadium, you start spending money on Barnby, Janino, spent 10 million was just kind of normal, where I know certainly from when I did my first book, looking at 1992, a million, 2 million, if you're spending that on a player, that was kind of, that they were your big signings for the summer. But, you know, great form from Villa to kind of be consistent, yeah, all the way through.
They were
the
very
season.
Consistent. Yeah. I mean, partly driven by Little's, I mean, he barely ever changed the team, Rob. Like, it was almost bizarre. And even, you know, the Coca-Cola Cup run, you know, even though we were playing teams, you know, that we would really dispatch fairly easily in the early rounds, he still played the side that played in the league the previous Saturday, you know, and they were so well drilled that you know, it was phenomenal, really. And I think it must have been, you know, a big ask for some of the players, but I think Little just had that vision and sold it to them in that way. So, yeah, that helped consistency.
If you look at the appearance stats as well, which I'm sure you've pored over many, many times, look for your book, 10 players appeared in over 40 games that season.
Yeah. I mean, that is phenomenal.
Is ridiculous, considering one of them is Paul McGrath as well, who was written off at the time he signed for Villa as someone who, you know, was not got many years left. I mean, you've got three players who played 50 games.
Yeah, and that is phenomenal, isn't it? And that's what, I mean, that just bears out the point, is that he had such a consistent style, you know, and it was only the odd injury, really. So, like, you know, if Ian Taylor had a knock, you know, Tommy Johnson might play, that sort of thing. But, yeah, there was, you know, so it's interesting, actually, I was doing some stuff about some kind of forgotten heroes of 94 and 96. And actually, it's harder for 96 because there weren't that many players that were kind of on the periphery, because he didn't have a great, you know, a huge squad. Because he just was so fixed on this way of playing with his side. And yeah, I mean, to have three players that played over 50 games is almost, well, unheard of, isn't it?
Definitely. And would you say, we've talked a lot about Villa's inability maybe to be a prolific goal scoring team. Would you say one of the strongest parts about this League Cup triumph was the actual defence? Because if you look at the run, there's only Peterborough and Arsenal who score past Villa then, and that was only in two of the games. So it wasn't like, you know, it was a couple of goals here and there. It was one game against Peterborough and Dennis Bergkamp, who, you know, we'll allow to score a couple of goals because he was a brilliant player. But actually, do you feel like it was that strength in the system, in the unity, in the defensive shape that actually supported Villa? And then obviously the final, you end up winning 3-0. So it was kind of almost that yin and yang, wasn't it?
It was. And that, I mean, I think we were incredibly solid under Little, and that kind of that back five or kind of, you know, slightly, you know, obviously Charles and Wright would provide a bit of width when we were attacking, but, you know, in essence, a back five and a midfield three kind of inevitably made us that. And I think that there were players in there, you know, like the likes of Gareth Southgate who were very creative within that, and Hugo could bring the ball out incredibly well. So we were very solid. I think the midfield three absolutely protected us. I think that, so you're right, that is absolutely a key element of the successful season. The other key bit, though, I think, is Dwight York finally playing through the middle as a striker, which he'd never really had the chance to do, Rob, which is amazing, because I mean, he'd been at Villa since Graham Taylor, you know, so, and a succession of managers had, he quite often used to play on the wing, or he'd come in if Saunders was unfit for a game and kind of drifting out. You know, scored his fair share of goals, but was never sort of just told by a manager, right, you're my main striker and you're going to play through the middle every week and let's go. And so I think his form that season was phenomenal. And I mean, you mentioned, you know, Dennis Bergkamp in the semi-final. But Dwight's two goals in that semi-final at Highbury as well, you know, just he was just on fire that season. And unfortunately, began the trajectory that would end up with him leaving Villa, I guess, because he was so good. But so I think those kind of twin things were important, because Savo, you know, people understood he might need a bit of time, etc. But he obviously didn't set the world on fire in that season. But then in the final, scored an absolute wonder goal, you know, from outside the box to put us 1-0 up in the final against Leeds. Then supplemented by goals from Ian Taylor and Dwight York. So, yeah, a good mix of really solid foundations built from that consistency of both selection and results in the league. But then, yeah, Dwight up front was something else that season.
He was brilliant, wasn't he? I do feel like I owe Milosevic an apology from my memory, because, you know, Misalotovic was always the what he ended up getting called a lot of the time. But actually, his goal scoring record wasn't that bad, especially that season as well in the Premier League. Got 12 goals and 6 assists. Now, if that's the modern age, that's what, 60 million, 70 million?
Oh, yeah,
these
yeah.
Days? You know, it's quite easily one of your big signings, isn't it? If you were to sell him on, you know, thinking about what players leave a club for now. And obviously, he had a pretty good goal scoring record through the rest of his career playing in La Liga. He was a pretty good goal scorer.
And internationally, you know. I mean, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think you know, and I think he was always, because you know, as much as the decision for Little to make Dwight the main man, I guess that did have an impact on Savo as well a little bit, because he was then that sort of second striker, which, you know, perhaps, you know, I've just been writing about Antoine Griezmann, and that sort of, you know, that he was almost being asked to be like a Griezmann, well, or what we now know as a Griezmann type player, but he wasn't quite that, so he couldn't drift around as much as perhaps that second striker should. So I think it was unfortunate in that sense. But yeah, I mean, he, you know, his record was okay, you know, and I think there wasn't, you know, it was only really later on when he kind of fell out with Villa fans and, you know, very famously spat at someone in Ewood Park, that it started to unravel a bit. But yeah, you know, a popular figure really in his time.
I think whenever you're part of a club that wins something and does well in the league, you know, you're always going to have that element of being connected to a club, and you're always going to get invited back, hopefully, for the, you know, the 20-year anniversary and the 40-year anniversary and everything like that. From your point of view, Ivan, you know, thinking about writing a book, and we all probably feel like we've got one or 10 in us at some point, why was this book important for you to write, and kind of how did you set about this journey of writing about this very particular period in Villa's history?
If I was going to write a book, it would always have been this period, because it was such a formative period, you know, for me as a, you know, as a teenager. You know, I was, what, 12 in 1994. And, you know, my love of Villa and my passion for Villa as a football fan that, you know, continues to this day, and as fortunately or unfortunately has been sort of passed down to my son, is about, you know, I always like to think, you know, this was formed in these years, you know, and it was those winning, you know, winning those trophies in 94, 96 was just so exceptional. It's also important for me to have written about it and speak about it, because obviously the fairly sad thing about it all is that Villa haven't won a major trophy since as well. And I think therefore it's important. It was important for me to remember that time, but also to remind people how important it is to win trophies. You know, we at Villa, we've had a lot of discussion over the past couple of seasons about what's more important, winning a trophy or finishing in fourth, or, you know, or in the Champions League spots. And, you know, my strong belief, Rob, is that I really want us to win a trophy. And if that is at the cost of finishing seventh or something, then so be it. Because, you know, I'm now a 43-year-old man who hasn't seen us win a trophy since 1996. And, you know, I've got a 13-year-old son who's never seen us win a trophy. And I just think, for clubs, it's so important that we have these moments to not just hang everything off, but to really celebrate, you know, what teams can do. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you would have had views on it yourself, but, you know, to look at Newcastle this season, you know, Spurs, you know, Spurs winning the Europa and all those sorts of things. These are moments that those fan bases will never, ever forget. And so, yeah, that's a couple of the reasons why it was important to me.
Yeah, you're not going to have a parade for earning £80 million more for finishing fourth than if you win an FA Cup or a League Cup or a Conference League or whatever. And that's what you remember as a fan, isn't it? And what you pass down to the next generation is not, I remember that time we finished fourth. I mean, you might enjoy that and you might have had a great season. You've loved every minute of it. Yeah. But actually, you know, telling them what it was like to walk up the steps at Wembley, or to look down Wembley Way and see, you know, a sea of Aston Villa shirts or Middlesbrough or Crystal Palace or whoever it might be, you can't forget that. You know, you can't forget those moments. And my time as a fan, you know, probably a little bit like yours, it was growing up with, you know, our chairman saying you put out your full team in the cup, because, you know, as a football club, that's where you've got a pretty good chance of winning 6 out of 8 games and you get to Wembley. Then you can enjoy a day at Wembley. And if you are lucky enough to win, I mean, we were in 3 consecutive cup finals and we lost all 3. You know, if you'd have won one of them, maybe your whole club changes.
Maybe, yeah, that trajectory. Yeah, no.
You just never know. And I think for Villa, obviously, I certainly remember a couple of seasons after this where with John Gregory in charge, and it looked like you were going to win the league.
Yeah, we were, you know, Christmas, all that stuff.
And if you look at all that sort of maybe up to the Cup final maybe at Wembley, the Chelsea defeat. You know, that eight-year span, yeah, you might have flirted the 17th and 18th. But actually, it was probably a really great time. You've got great players, getting to cup finals, you're challenged at the right end of the table, a couple of great wins in Europe. I think you beat Inter Milan, I think, didn't you, on penalties at one point. So yeah. All of that goes into...
King scored the winning penalty.
Yeah, all of that goes into it. And yeah, it would be great that you've, you know, obviously had a great time in the Champions League and beating some good teams and stuff like that. But these are the things you sort of hang your hat on. And I feel like what's happened is the teams that get in the Champions League still win trophies.
And the teams who are
out of it, you know, the Villa who are trying to get in there, the Newcastle who are trying to get in there, you do want a trophy every few years to kind of keep you going. And because it is hard, isn't it? It is hard competing at the top end of the table. If you were going to write another book about Aston Villa, you may already be thinking about it or doing it. What would be another time period or a player or a manager or an era that you think, actually, yeah, that's the time that...
Well, yeah, may or may not be in the early stages, but yeah, I mean, it would be the Martin O'Neill era, which, again, is, you know, on the surface of it, probably isn't that much to celebrate. I mean, we finished sixth 3 years in a row, but I think it was quite an interesting time because it was this idea of a kind of ceiling and that we couldn't quite break into, and despite having a really good side. But again, it's quite an important time for me as a fan. I wasn't living in the Midlands at the time. I was living in Manchester, Liverpool. So watched Villa a lot away from home. And it was, you know, under O'Neill, we beat United, Old Trafford, beat Liverpool, Anfield, all that sort of thing. So, you know, really iconic team for me. Ashley Young, James Milner, later Stuart Downing, John Carew, people like that. And I do think it's an interesting idea that, yeah, we could never quite make that jump, you know, and I think then actually probably as a club, largely until, well, that was a period, the fact that we didn't make that step up at that point probably was the beginning of the what ended in relegation in 2016. So
I feel like we need to do a us and them, Middlesbrough versus Aston and Villa, because 2006, obviously, we got into the UEFA Cup final and lost. Obviously, McLaren went to England. Martin O'Neill was top of the list of managers for Middlesbrough, but we didn't want him to bring his own coaching staff with him, which obviously done for, what, 10 years, 11
yeah,
years, I think.
Yeah,
that was part of his, part of the deal. So we didn't go for him. Obviously, went for Southgate. And when you look back now, as a Borough fan, God, I would kill for 3 6th-place finishes in a row, considering that same four-year period or five-year period at Villa. We ended up slowly moving down the table, getting relegated, and then having Gordon Strachan spend about £10 million on players who weren't good enough from Scotland. So it is interesting. You get to those points in your club and you think you went that way and we went the other way. You know, so it is quite an interesting... obviously, there's the Middlesbrough fan throwing their season ticket at Steve McLaren during Aston Villa's 4-0 demolition of us at... the Riverside.
Although, and there's some irony, I mean, a bit before then, but I mean, you know, some of the names, obviously you mentioned Townsend, but of course, Hugo and Southgate both left Villa to, I quote, win things at Middlesbrough, I think was
that's
Hugo's
right.
line.
Yeah.
So yeah, a bit of, I wasn't impressed by that.
And he did win something, to be fair.
Yeah, he was a wonderful servant.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few links. I think Steve Harrison, I think, was coach at Villa, for a period of time.
Yeah.
Obviously, came to Borough when McLaren arrived. So there's definitely down the years probably some players that we've had in both clubs. And obviously, we won't mention the end of the Premier League season in this podcast at all about Aston Villa, but a really enjoyable season. I'm really disappointed that we didn't get any Morgan Rodgers related Champions League bonus that we might still have been owed by Aston Villa from that game. But where do you see the future of Villa now? Is there a trophy on the horizon under someone like Unai Emery, who's kind of made a bit of a name for himself for winning cup competitions? Do you think that might be something, especially with, I know you'd rather be in the Champions League, but actually in the Europa League, where you may well be one of the favourites? I mean, surely that's going to be a fantastic run.
I would have said this had we been having a conversation before the end of the season. As long as we were in Europe, Rob, I wasn't massively concerned. I think that is really important. A third season consecutive in Europe, you know, is not to be sniffed at. So I think obviously there is preference of competition in some ways, but yeah, Unai's record in the Europa League is phenomenal, and perhaps you only have to look at who were the finalists this season to suggest that the quality of that that sort of second tiered qualification is, you know, is maybe not as strong. So yeah, and I think, you know, he's clearly, you know, Unai has transformed the club, and you know, I wrote about him for the Villa magazine for These Football Times, and you know, and it's instructive just to see how much he has really, you know, turned the culture around, the expectation, but that expectation that's rooted in, you know, a kind of reality. And I think that this season it was really good to see that he took the FA Cup seriously. Well, apart from the semi-final possibly. But yeah, it was, you know, so I think that bodes well. And I think that, you know, again, it goes back to that idea of trophies. You know, people, whatever happens, people will remember Unai incredibly fondly at Villa. But if he could win a trophy just to cement that status, that would add a layer of kind of weight to that legacy, I guess.
Yeah, and he really is. He's a fantastic manager. I think he's an absolutely brilliant manager. And what a great manager to have at your club trying to take you forward, because it's such a massive thing to get that right. You know, in the modern era, to get the right manager at the right time is really hard. And obviously, Monchi behind the scenes is certainly a great wheeler dealer and gets some great players for you at Aston Villa. But it's been fantastic sort of reminiscing about this 90s period. We love doing it on the Decades podcast at These Football Times as well. But Only the Real Thing is out now. Obviously, it's been out for a little while. But if you've not read it yet, it is a brilliant read. And I thoroughly enjoyed reading it myself. And certainly as a 90s football fan, you know, looking in the modern era, maybe some of the trophies get kind of won by the same little cycle of teams. You know, it's great to see Crystal Palace win one this year. It was not great to see Newcastle United win a trophy this year, but it's nice to see someone different to Manchester City, who felt like they'd had a bit of a monopoly on the EFL Cup,
absolutely,
as it is now at the moment. But Ivan, thank you very much for your time. It's been a brilliant podcast to record.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
And we definitely need to record that Us and Them podcast with them, listing all those Middlesbrough and Aston Villa players that have crossed paths over time. But thank you to everybody who's listened to the podcast. Hope you do go out and enjoy the book and enjoy that Villa magazine when that hits. I'm certainly looking forward to reading through that one as well. Thanks, Ivan. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please do like, share, rate, and review, and all that other stuff that you need to do with your podcasts. Thanks a lot.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.